Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Indira Aluvalia. Indira leads Cower Strategies to enable authentic and transformative growth through advisory and coaching services. Recently, Indira founded and chairs the Coalition for Racial and Ethnic Equity in Development, known as CREED, which launched a racial and ethnic equity pledge and created a learning community to advance racial and ethnic diversity, equity, and belonging in U.S.-based international development organizations. Previously, Indira founded Development and Training Services Incorporated, which helped support equality, accountability, and sustainability development projects in 90 countries. So Indira, thank you so much for coming on the Tolerable Risk podcast today. I'm really excited to have you on the show to talk about CREED.
Thank you, Sabrina. I'm really humbled to be part of Tolerable Risk and talk to you about what's important to both of us, racial and ethnic equity and CREED.
Excellent. So before we get into the topic today, can you just tell everybody a little bit more about yourself, about your background, and how you got into the third sector?
You know, it's always a great question, and it makes me pause to think, when was I not working on some form of building equity or equality or fighting for the underdog? And I think that it's just innate in how I was raised or how I've lived my life as a Sikh to know that equity or equality is everybody's responsibility. And if you see pathways that advance it, that's the pathway one has to follow. So no matter the kind of work I've done, whether it's been international development or any kind of advocacy or nonprofit leadership, it's the mission or the thrust of the work has been tempered by building mutual respect, building equality, building equity, but by recognizing the strength of each individual's uniqueness. And so that sense of working for something bigger and stronger is what drives me.
That's so great. As you're talking, I envision everybody pulling together and everybody coming together creates something that's just so much bigger and more impactful than each of us trying to do it on our own.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself.
CREED is the Coalition for Racial and Ethnic Equity in Development. So what is CREED? Tell me about it. How did you come up with founding it and the purpose? Tell us more about it.
Absolutely. And thank you again for this opportunity. I think it was about 2018, 2019 that the U.S. aid space in the Washington area was already dealing with creating dialogue about equality or diversity. There was enough talk about different aspects of diversity that one, you know, heard about it at conferences. It came up in strategy discussions or HR within the organizations in the USAID ecosystem, in the implementing partners and professional associations. And one of the things I realized, it was almost like the blind man and the elephant, where everybody was trying to figure it out and not really calling out what it was as a whole. Ultimately, it's not enough to say we must have diverse people in our organizations. It's more relevant to say, how does an organization succeed on the basis of diverse lived experience? So I started pushing this dialogue among some of the leaders and trying to create an opportunity where we could talk about what systemic racism leads to. The argument isn't about whether there is discrimination or racism or what the legacy of that is. The dialogue that we need to be in is, how do we create equality, equity, dignity, respect for each individual and for a system to be honorable, to allow each individual to succeed so that each leader is responsible for every individual, not just the people he or she understands better. And I think the tipping point of having these discussions, in all honesty, was the death of a Black man on television. And not something that hasn't happened before and not something that has stopped happening since, but it allowed us to crystallize with clarity that we have to take the power we have to do what we can. And in that moment, we created an opportunity for leaders to come together who were willing to use their voice, who already stood for racial and ethnic equity, and to say, how do we take what's in your manageable control and create a movement. So Creed came with 20 organizations coming together. And of the 20, about 9 organizations formed a core team. And this core team, we spent about a year from about 2021 February to 2022 February, crystallizing, formulating, developing content, but more importantly, debating in a safe space of this group of 9 with very different ethnic, racial, gender backgrounds to say, what does racial and ethnic equity mean? And how can this movement be effective in a way that we're not just being compliant and we're not going for the low-hanging fruit? We're trying to change the way in which we lead and manage, implement, and create partnerships within the organization.
There's so much to unpack with everything you just said. I want to focus really on, you were saying, not just compliant. We don't just want to be compliant. And that's a theme that I've found that goes through the website that you have. So the website for Creed is Creed in Action. So C-R-E-E-D in action.org. One of the themes that you have going through there is it's not just about compliance. It's not just about ticking a box. It's really about integrating this into how organizations function. You have a frequently asked question page on the website, and I love question number 6 that says, why doesn't this pledge, and I want you to talk about the Creed pledge as well, but why doesn't it address programming? And the answer there is really, well, we're less interested in programming and more interested in ensuring that organizations essentially are living their values. And so this really isn't just a compliance effort for the members of Creed. This is really ensuring that how organizations operate is taking into consideration racial and ethnic equity, which I think is fantastic.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. And that's the essence of it. I'll give you a visual. Several years ago, somebody shared this cartoon with me, just one picture, about participation, about compliance. It's a boardroom and the room has people, men and women, sitting at the table. And yes, you know, you can check the box. This is a setting of powerful people. And yes, there are men and then there are women. But if you look a little bit more closely at this, the women are actually bound and gagged, still participating.
That's a picture's worth a thousand words.
Picture's worth a thousand words. So compliance allows you to get in the door. Compliance doesn't give you voice. Compliance does not create belonging. Compliance does not create enough to mitigate risk. And ultimately, we act because we're threatened by liability. We don't act. When we see risk, we think we can push risk off till we're sued, till we are dealing with a reputational risk, till we feel our peers are speaking to issues better, stronger than we are, and it makes us not look as supportive of things that are in the public eye right now. So to me, in terms of compliance, it wasn't enough. It was ultimately about saying, when we created Creed, what is a baseline that we can establish? So we created the racial and ethnic equity pledge. We did this very intentionally. So the pledge itself has 5 components. The idea was not to have 25 high, lofty components that 24 of them would be very easy to check off. These had to be activities, standards that the leaders who were working to create it, which we created collaboratively using the founding core team and the founding members. We also had it checked and rechecked by industry, including clients and other implementing partners through an external review. The goal was for us to say, is this something as a leader I feel I can implement? And can I implement it in a reasonable amount of time? Can I take from this pledge what is most needed in my organization? We did make it aspirational, given that we knew that the baseline didn't exist even. We also wanted to ensure that it wasn't judgmental. We're starting a journey with intention. We're starting a journey with a desire to do this. And so we wanted to create a safe space. So the first of the 5 components starts with building a racial and ethnic equity policy. Unless you define what you're pursuing, you don't have a clear target. So creating a policy that stands different from your DEIA perspective and focuses specifically on racial and ethnic equity.
I just ask you, what is the difference between REE, so racial and ethnic equity, and DEI, diversity, yes, equity, and inclusion? Because people might say, well, aren't these two basically the same things? You're just calling it something different. But Creed believes that there is a difference. So if we're talking about writing policies and documentation, just can you talk a little bit about the difference between those two?
Absolutely. And a fair question. So diversity is a whole plethora of identifiers for an individual or a community. It includes my racial background, my ethnic background, my religious background, my national origin, my gender. It allows me to be my full capacity. Racial and ethnic equity focuses on two elements of diversity. It focuses on race and ethnicity. And certainly, there's a lot to unpack with race and ethnicity, and it's also geographically specific. What's important in terms of race in the U.S. is very different than what's important in another country. So recognizing that there's a legacy that we're dealing with, a history, a day-to-day lived experience, which is different in how people who are brown and black live and function and lead and decide. The idea that racial and ethnic equity is important comes also from a survey that was done in the industry. The survey spoke to BIPOC people, people of black, indigenous, and people of color in the international development sector in the U.S. The Bridge survey provided information about racial and ethnic equity in the U.S. in the international development sector. 6% of BIPOC males are CEOs and 4% of BIPOC females are CEOs in our industry. And I believe this was released in 2021. So my being a CEO of my company is rare as a Indian American Sikh woman. That was very striking. We have a lot of excellent diversity in the middle management. We have a lot of racial, particularly an ethnic diversity in our operations units, in our back offices, but not always in our boardroom and clearly not always in our leadership. So creating a policy that was intentional in saying, what is the goal of your organization with regard to racial and ethnic equity and what systems will you be able to integrate it forms component one.
I like that it's policies and systems, right? So you're not just saying write a document that we all know, you know, policies may or may not be read, policies may or may not be enforced, policies may or may not be interpreted the way you want. But you say policies and systems. And one of the things that you do highlight in the systems area is internal reporting for racial and ethnic bias and public disclosure on REE policy impact. That is huge. We don't have a whole lot of public disclosure in the third sector. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. If we can normalize talking about making racial and ethnic equity a goal, then talking about how far we have to go is part of the process. It's, again, not from a perspective of judgment, but if it is a strategic goal, then it's about reach and how we are able to be transparent about the realities, which is visible to everybody. So the idea of creating accountability and communications and transparency form two other components in the pledge. And I can just articulate that from the perspective that it's not enough to have a policy if you're not going to implement it. If you're going to implement it and you're going to put resources into it, then you should have metrics. And if you're going to believe in this and you're going to stand for it, then get up on the bully pulpit and speak to it and be the role model that you can be. So it's from that perspective of normalizing this journey and creating pathways. Very often people are very well intentioned, but they don't know how. So with this pledge, what we also want to do is create a roadmap. Each pledge component has a standard, but it also has associated values. In addition, has a roadmap. It gives you examples of how to create a policy or what a policy could include, and then has indicators and the outcome. At this point, our goal is to build dialogue, create this in an organic way once it's systematized into organizations. And so that it's organic because the leaders have taken responsibility. The leaders are seeing the value of it. The leaders are devoting resources to it. And the leaders are willing to be transparent, therefore be held accountable for it.
I just love how you're speaking and what you were talking about with this public disclosure element and how just very bold it is. And you shouldn't have to be bold in this area, but I think that it's so refreshing that these organizations that have signed up for the pledge are, in a way, being quite bold, because a lot of times, at least the interactions that I've had with leadership teams, people are afraid to make that public commitment for fear of being held accountable. For fear of being held accountable, they would rather just sit and not do anything at all. And so I think this is really refreshing and it's very bold and it's something that's really needed in the sector.
I fully agree. And the reality is you either deal with it when you see it as a strategic opportunity.
Definitely.
Or you deal with it when you see there's a risk in your organization, or you are going to deal with it when you have a liability.
Absolutely.
It's a different time. Yeah. We are past the place of being complacent in being well-intentioned.
Let's talk about component two then, people, leadership, and organizational structure. Tell us a little bit about this component and how it fits into the puzzle.
You know, this component was a must-have as well, because at the end of the day, it's the balance between system and people that will make the difference. If component one was about the system, component two is ensuring that the people are also protected. And very often we speak to recruitment. We don't speak enough to retention. We speak to mentorship, but not enough about how do you sponsor the process of advancing a mentee. We also speak to parity in some ways, but this is to ensure that we make parity front and center. We are keen to look at it from the perspective of growth. We're keen to look at it from the perspective of having been a founder of my own organization, as an example. The issue of thinking that you're dispensable, I know, is a hard one. But as we look at growth, we're looking at succession planning. That's the responsibility of any leader. When you think deliberately about succession planning, you have opportunities to ensure that you're bringing the right context into how you make decision making. That allows succession planning to be more open. We also look at board expansion, not only to add color to the board, because that seems to be a good trend. There are talents that are missing on the board. There are skill sets. There are lived experiences. There is expertise that needs to be added to the board that is not just about adding one brown or black person. So looking at it from a perspective of respect, looking at it in terms of what that different perspective will bring is part of component two.
So actually, we have another episode of Tolerable Risk where we're talking to a gentleman by the name of Malcolm John, and he focuses on racial diversity among trustees in the United Kingdom. And he raised that point too, talking about how you don't just add one black or brown or Asian person to the board for the sake of tokenism, right? Then that's just tokenism, but really for the diverse point of view and thinking that they'll bring to the table. And we talked a lot on that episode about what you also mentioned just now is the lived experience, wanting to make sure that you have people on the board who can represent and speak to those lived experiences. It makes your programming better. It makes your organization better. It really ensures that your organization is living your values.
I like that a lot. And, you know, it comes down to imposing versus including.
Well, that takes us then to component three, I think, when we're talking about culture, organizational culture. So component three focuses on that and the physical experience as well as psychological safety, which you hear a lot about these days, both in the public sector, the private sector, the third sector, a lot of talk about psychological safety. So can you talk a little bit about this component?
Absolutely. So component one was systems, component two is people, but unless you are integrating it into your actions and it comes from your values, it's all talk. So culture is creating a safe place for me to be my best. It creates the opportunity for me not to worry about whether I will be heard if I use my voice, whether I will be punished for having a different perspective. It's also a place where people don't have to defend their accent. They don't have to defend a limp. They don't have to defend the length of their beard. They don't have to defend a headgear. They don't have to protect their hair from being touched. These are basic human dignities that we must create as the foundation of organizations when we lead. Because if we don't create dignity, we don't get respect ourselves.
Dignity is such a core element to it. And in a way, it's so simple, but it's complicated.
It is. But, you know, we've got to play nice in the playground.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I think it's just very simple. I think fundamentally, people are good. I think fundamentally, people want to feel included no matter what race, ethnicity, gender. They also want to be recognized for putting in their best effort. The reality is that creating racial and ethnic equity is an expertise. It's a technical field. So while intentions can be good if you want to build equity and equality and parity, there's a process, there's a system, and there's learned experience of what's worked in your organization and not. So even creating culture as a space where people feel safe to belong and to produce good results is a technical field. And I think we don't want to minimize that it needs special attention. It needs specific experts and it needs political will.
One of the things that I love about the website is that you have a glossary section. And so related to component three, organizational culture, and you're talking about the psychological safety element, I just want to read the first sentence for the definition. Psychological safety is the belief that one won't be punished, so we're talking about retaliation there, or humiliated, which we were just talking about with dignity, for speaking up with regards to one's ideas, questions, concerns, or mistakes. That's a brilliant kind of way of framing psychological safety. I want to ask you that when you're talking about how this is a technical field, right? You know, diversity, equity, inclusion, psychological safety, you know, it's a technical field. When you frame it like that, that can be quite intimidating for small or medium-sized organizations who may already feel a little bit overwhelmed trying to do the right thing and get into this space. And then if they hear you say, well, this is a technical field and you really have to have some skills or expertise in it, they might just sort of throw up their hands and go, well, you know, we don't have the resources for that. We can't bring a consultant in. So when you say that this is a technical field, what do you mean by that?
You know, I think it's not something that you know how to do if you haven't researched it, if you haven't practiced it, if you haven't been in a situation where you've had to troubleshoot what works, what doesn't work. What we all carry is basic empathy. We all carry the sense of doing well for ourselves as much as for what we're working within. As an example, the pledge creates five pathways. If you were to take parity just as an example, how do you go about creating parity? How do you first get past the fear of liability if you start getting transparent, even in a small executive team kind of way? How do you get to the point of understanding what your baseline is and what the differences are? How do you determine the reconciliation? How do you communicate it in a way that protects you from liability? All of this comes with a healthy dose of common sense. But you want to also bring in HR. You want to talk to your CFO. And in the same way, there is research you can do, or your HR person can do, or if the CEO is the HR, as I have been in my small organization when I started, it's educating yourself. And you would educate yourself if you were looking at writing a proposal in a sector that you're bringing your expertise into. You would educate yourself about the context. Similarly, it's a needed investment. It doesn't have to be a $1,000 a day consultant for 30 days over the next 3 months. It could be conversations through a limited engagement. It could be research. It could be delegating an intern to gather this information and giving you a comprehensive brief that you as the leader with the person who's running your HR and your CFO put your heads together to say, this is what is going to work in our context.
So when you're talking about this being a technical field, what you're really advising people is don't just step off the cliff. Don't go into it blind. Make sure that you're reading best practices. Make sure that you are exploring how you can learn different approaches and be aware of if you're starting to have these tough conversations, the types of feelings and emotions that it might bring up or things like that. Is that what you're advising when you're saying it's sort of a technical field?
Yes, absolutely. Because we're bringing our own biases.
Sure.
But we are educating ourselves in the same way that we would if we had to learn a sector or a context or a situation that was new to us to implement in that space.
Okay.
So absolutely. Yes, there are good practices, best practices, models, and also experts who are immediate short-term consultants as you face a situation.
I think it takes us to component 4, accountability, which is the one that I love the most. Because what I have found is there's a lot of talk and a lot of good posturing and a lot of goodwill and maybe conversations in meetings. But when people are asked to put pen to paper or when people are asked to actually start implementing systems, like you were talking about earlier, that's when the brakes get put on and people get a little bit hesitant. So talk to me about component 4, about accountability.
Absolutely. So I think it's very simply recognizing that when we've written a policy, we've taken a position. Once we've taken that position, whether we're going to be held accountable in a manner that is formal or informal by your staff, by your ecosystem, is real. So the impetus is to deliver. It's not enough to have an open-ended commitment. It's recognizing that your open-ended commitment will be visible, and how you're measured is up to you. And I say that because ultimately it comes from the center, it comes from the leadership. And we all create some degree of key performance indicators in our organization. The question is, can we create key performance indicators that speak to diversity or racial and ethnic equity at an organizational level as an organizational indicator? But then can we also establish those indicators for performance of leaders and staff? So we do have some good models on how you can create indicators on behavior. And what we're really trying to hold accountable is behavior, is opportunity, is funding. So the idea is that we build this sort of accountability in the system, which will allow us to have clear measures both at an organizational and staff level.
So this component talks a lot about metrics. And whenever people think about metrics and measurement, they think quantitatively. And I can see some people right now listening to this episode and shaking their head and getting worried about things like quotas. What kind of metrics, for example, you said you're trying to measure behavior, but what kind of metrics have you seen, knowing that it's not one size fits all, but can you give some examples of metrics that would be supportive of this accountability component?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let's just look at staffing. You can create a quota or you can create a target, but ultimately it's important to have a goal. I'll give you an example of on the board. There are set considerations now in several organizations about expanding the diversity on the board. And whether it says, well, we're going to add the one token Black man or the one token brown female, that whether we call it a measure or not is already a measure. Can we be thoughtful about the impact tokenism will have versus strategic imperative? So we're asking that people think about what is missing in terms of the outcomes they want, and having a governance body that reflects that gap be taken into consideration and have that be a target. Similarly, as one looks at executive leadership, what is the composition? It can be very, very quantitative in that manner, but it also has to be done on the basis of the qualitative impact and the subliminal impact that we want to have. As I'd mentioned in the US, with our space in the middle management level, there's tremendous opportunity for greater diversity. It doesn't translate in the higher ranks often. So staffing provides very concrete quantitative measures. The ways in which you can measure emotion, behavior, lived experience in your organization is, you know, certainly through the pulse surveys, many people do ensuring that they are in anonymous, but also employee advisory councils, where you create some degree of anonymous reporting, where it's not just filling a survey that goes into a black hole that is represented in some meeting and taken into consideration at some point, but giving voice to that through trusted employees to represent it is another concrete way of looking at metrics becoming more alive, because you're hearing more directly what needs to be improved, which will allow you to create a target.
So one of the other questions I have about accountability, and I think it probably ties back to component 3, organizational culture, component 1, policies and systems, has to do with the whistleblower mechanism. We had Bobby Jefferson on Tolerable Risk as well, and he was talking about, you know, if you have somebody who is a serial offender and they're making really awful comments or they're demonstrating that they're racist, but they happen to be under the protective wing of somebody quite powerful in the organization, what does that do? If we're talking about psychological safety and we're talking about accountability within organizations, within their organizational culture, can you talk a little bit about the importance of tools like that and what organizations need to do to demonstrate that they are holding themselves accountable?
That's a very important question. Let's speak to microaggressions and let's talk about the weight of microaggressions on somebody who is dealing with on a constant basis. Microaggressions from the perspective of the person making comments that are hurtful or with intention or through unconscious bias has a way of stripping self-respect from the person receiving it. It's done in a way that is so subtle, but so clear that you don't belong. I was at a meeting a couple of years ago, and this person came up wanting to make conversation and, you know, do the standard networking. It's very visible that I am likely Indian by heritage. It's not visible how long I've lived in the US because the gentleman asked me how the weather was in India. And, you know, you wonder about the comment for a moment and you say, interesting, because he doesn't think I belong. If he's going to ask me about the weather in India, while I live in Washington, D.C. and have lived here since I was 15. Now, there's a couple of ways in which the person who was a bystander to this conversation could react. Depends on the culture of the organization. And what I'm speaking to now is there might be an ignorant comment. The person who's receiving it may be caught off guard. The person listening as a third party in this may also feel uncomfortable. But if the culture is ignorance is not welcome here, disrespect is not welcome here, then your instinct to say, where are you coming from, to the speaker may be more readily accessible emotionally, both to the person the comment is addressed to or the behavior is addressed to and anybody witnessing it. So it's creating a space where people don't feel they can walk up and touch a Black woman's hair or a Sikh man's turban or ask why a person speaks well in English or doesn't have an accent. Microaggressions are really something that we are talking about, but it's whether our culture holds the person accountable for getting away with. Our accountability doesn't often go down to the level of redressing microaggressions. We're looking for the big ticket items to hold and make examples of. But we also want to have a culture that doesn't ridicule or mock or humiliate or belittle a coworker. And the reverse is also true. If you have a leader who is BIPOC, their credibility is often questioned till they prove themselves time and time again. So culture has to be inclusive of making sure all people in an organization are respected.
I think your examples about microaggressions are right on, because I myself have witnessed it. And as a bystander, sometimes you're just like, what just happened? What am I supposed to do right now? If I know the person that it happened to, I certainly go up to them afterwards and say, are you all right? I heard that. You're not crazy. You know, you don't want them to think that they're being gaslit, right? Like, did they just hear that? And the other thing I would ask is, if you're an organization like you were saying, Indira, that was saying, well, the microaggressions aren't something that they're really looking at. They're just looking for the big ticket items. Would you say that by tolerating the microaggressions, you're actually making it harder on yourself to hold the big ticket items accountable? Because essentially you're creating a culture where these things are acceptable.
You know, I agree with that. I think by tolerating, by enacting microaggressions, you're permitting racism. You're part of what is creating and perpetuating a lack of respect on your watch. And it's the little stuff that gives us permission to do the big stuff. It's that first touch that makes the victim uncomfortable. That should never be allowed. And what is the most fundamentally important part of Creed is creating an environment when we can talk about how people need to be respected for who they are. Very simply, we're saying we need to respect the other human being with whom we are interacting with. Coming from that place of mutual empathy, we don't push another human being down. We cannot. That's not tolerable. And especially if you have leadership in your job title, you are responsible for each person whose paycheck you sign because you've taken that responsibility. And in that responsibility, you have taken that you will help that individual succeed at that job. An individual will succeed at that job when their core is respected. And when you cross over physical space and emotional space to say, I have power over you, and I will use that power to belittle you or to deny you, your organization has lost.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you were talking about that is the role of a leader, exactly like you were saying. And that takes us then to component 5 about communications and transparency. And the standard you have here is that leaders speak credibly and openly about REE goals, progress and outcomes internally and externally. And I like that it's both. So tell us about component 5.
Absolutely. You know, I think the fundamental tenet here is normalizing differences. It's about a leader saying, I want to learn. I may not know everything. I want to surround myself with opportunities through which I can grow so I can lead all people and create effectiveness in my organization. It's about saying that you are valued no matter where you come from as a staff member. It's about saying that as a leader, this is my goal. These are my values. Very often, we have these values of respect, of inclusion, of integrating differences in a way that benefits all. But we get focused on the big strategic object or the ERP reform or a particular segment of the business. We forget that we're leading a group of people who want to be heard and seen. And as a leader, it's very important to speak from vulnerability and to demonstrate strength. And to say, I see you and I welcome you to be part of our solutions. If we have a leader open with that, the tone in which the leader speaks allows for more inherent connection between the staff and the leader. The authentic leadership is seeing reality and still leading with integrity.
Love how one of the elements of this component is about creating feedback loops with staff and externally with other organizations with intentional focus on racial and ethnic communities. This sort of takes us back to accountability, because if you are going to be communicating internally and externally, then you're making these statements, you're making these declarations, and you're asking to be held accountable, which again, I think is very bold and is very inspiring.
Appreciate that. I mean, if you kind of take that thread right through it and you have a policy that speaks to creating parity in salaries from that first component, building into the second component, you create an environment where it's okay for somebody to come and speak about their salary to the right authorities in the organization to get clarity, to get understanding. You take the accountability as an organization to make sure people are paid for the job they're doing, not from the color of their skin. And you can share based on the pulse surveys or based on your HR baseline data, how things have changed based on creating greater inclusion. You can systemically and culturally build belonging that allows for equity in practice, but also allows an organization that is a safe place for people to grow. And it demonstrates that leaders are willing to be held accountable. Because you've gone from saying, I believe in equity, to creating a policy, to applying it to salaries, to holding people responsible for speaking up, not staying quiet because of fear, and then ensuring that we can measure the impact both in terms of productivity, in terms of outcomes, in terms of profits, but also being able to share and role model it in the community.
Yeah. Thank you so much for going over these five components, because each so interesting. And like you said, on the website, they all have a standard, an illustrative roadmap, examples of application, values that are related to them, outcomes and measures, which is really helpful because a lot of times organizations may not know where to start. And this is fantastic. Let me ask you then, if organizations that are listening today are saying, this sounds really inspirational, this sounds like something we want to do, but they want to be prepared, like you were saying, what would you say would be maybe the top two or three risks that they should be aware of as they're moving through this on their own journey? What should they be keeping an eye out for to make sure that they can have a successful implementation?
You know, I would say two things come to mind is don't ignore what you keep in your parking lot. Very often we get focused on a deadline or an urgent issue, and we keep adding issues that typically build while we're ignoring them in the parking lot. Those issues are sometimes intangible. Sometimes those issues are too hard to deal with or unravel, or are politically sensitive in that one aggressor that's repeatedly behaving in a way that is disrespectful towards women, or conduct, you've heard enough reports of small microaggressions that it's almost a pattern. So don't ignore what's in your parking lot, because that stuff is not going away. And you know it, but you're not able to deal with it, right? If you don't address things when they are building, they will become bigger and become huger liabilities. The other aspect is, as leaders and organizations with focal points in different parts of the organization, is lift the hood, look under the hood. We skim over issues that are brought to our notice that we observe walking down the hall or on Zoom call based on who speaks and who doesn't speak. We know when somebody in our staff is unhappy. We know when somebody is not producing to their best potential. We know when we have to address parity, but we're not quite sure how to. We know when we have a very homogeneous organizational leadership team or board, or all our minorities in our organization are doing accounting or HR. Look under the hood, see why it is so. Because again, the more you deploy leadership, the greater your liability.
Those are fantastic points, Indira. And what you were mentioning earlier about don't ignore what's in your parking lot, I want to put in another plug for an earlier episode that we have of Tolerable Risk with the HR professional named Isabel Sanosi. And she and I got into a really interesting conversation about what happens when your serial offenders are also high performers and how difficult it is. As Bobby was saying on his episode, maybe it's somebody that the client loves, or maybe it's somebody that is bringing in a lot of good business for the organization, but they are a disaster to work with. And how you handle that is not just going to impact that one person, but everybody watching, everybody across the organization, seeing how the organization is handling that offender is something that is going to be very telling as well.
Yes. You know, I think the serial offender, right? It's especially when an individual is powerful, especially when that individual is a rainmaker, especially when that individual is well-regarded, especially when you don't want that individual to go to your competition. You want to take a breath and you want to decide what you're protecting. Are you protecting future business or current business? Are you protecting one individual or all your employees? Are you protecting yourself from taking a risk of filling that position in a way that you're not confident of? When you don't release something that is not working, be it a cancer in your body or in your organization, it has implications. And whether you pay for it today, your lack of vigilance will catch up to you. It's not something that is not visible. The reality of that serial perpetrator is everybody is aware. But organizationally, we choose to protect what we think is going to give us the highest return and the least resistance in our own psyche. But that's where there's a huge difference between being a manager and a leader. A manager may well be focused on the process of reaching the outcome. The leader is looking at inspiring the outcome. And a leader manager, no matter what level, for an organization to succeed, it's not just about the process. It's not just about a single outcome. You have to choose whether the outcome you're protecting is bigger than the outcome you're striving for your entire organization and your responsibility.
That's really well said, Indira. And I agree with you 100%. And the differences that you highlight between being a leader and being a manager are quite stark. Speaking of leadership and management, if somebody is listening today and they are really inspired by what you're talking about, by Creed, by the pledge, how can they make a case to leadership and management? I use the term a business case because a lot of times it can be hard to find the resources. And when I say resources, I don't necessarily just mean money, but I mean staff time, agenda time, person time, brain focus time, dedication to these topics, because it's not something that's going to happen quickly. How could somebody make that business case for joining an organization like Creed or just taking the five components that we've talked about and integrating them into their organization? What is that business case?
No, I think that's a very important question. And just in terms of Creed itself, we ask that people consider signing the pledge, but only if they're willing to implement parts of the pledge or the components that work for your organization. This is not something that we take lightly. So when a CEO signs the pledge, it's something that we ask has been thought about by the C-suite with the right experts to make sure this is something the organization can implement. In terms of what is the business case for building equity, I think there's tremendous amount of good data that exists in terms of profit, in terms of markets, in terms of competitiveness, when you bring in different perspectives into your decision making. I think that what also needs to be highlighted is morale. Who would have thought pre-2020 we could work remotely? Who would have thought that we would have lost so many lives and we would still have to produce? So I think that the reality is we've got to kind of look up from where we've gotten used to working to see what will build a competitive edge in a market and in a world that is evolving much faster than the standard way of doing business. The youth that we have in our countries and our office are also not complacent. They are not raised the same way as some of the older generations were, where they will sit and take inequities. You can look for positive disruptions that will force you to consider how to move the needle, or you can be pioneering movements in your organization that inspire your team to produce in a way that comes from a sense of belonging rather than compliance. And there's a significant difference between complying, as I had spoken about that cartoon, versus thriving because somebody is belonging and bringing the best vision, the best experience, the synergies that allow for solutions that are more than vanilla.
That's great. I can imagine that it's still an uphill battle for some organizations, but one of the ways, maybe an angle or a strategy, could be trying to engage the board. And so on tolerable risk, I always ask, how can boards support what we're talking about today? And particularly taking into consideration that a lot of times trustees and board members of small to medium-sized organizations are volunteers. They're not professional board members. It might be their first time. They believe in the mission of the organization, but they may be hesitant. They might be afraid. They might have never done this before. They don't want to hurt the organization. They certainly don't want to look dumb in the boardroom. So for those new or inexperienced or just nervous board members and trustees for small to medium-sized organizations, what are three questions or pieces of data or ways that they can be engaging around things like racial and ethnic equity or DEI to ensure that the tone at the top from where they sit is something that is cascaded down through to leadership, management, and the rest of the organization?
You know, I think boards are in a unique position to create pathways for progress of the organization. By being a step removed, they certainly have clarity and objectivity and are able to see above the weeds. I think the sense that a board member has when I've been a board member is ensuring that the organization is aware of gaps. They're aware of leadership challenges, which, you know, oftentimes is harder to address from within, but also that they forward thinking, that they are looking at sustainability, competitiveness, and effectiveness of the organization, not just today, but in the years to come, and recognizing that diversity that is now inherently a part of every function, and looking at it from the perspective of how can that be harnessed? How can that be fueled to create greater innovation, to create more opportunities, to build more understanding is something that I think boards are struggling with and asking themselves, how do we recruit? Where do we even go to find that one person that fits with our organization? And I think the challenge is when you try to create a fit in a puzzle that's not fully formulated because it's incomplete, is taking that risk and bringing in a voice that is different by bringing in that perspective that will shake the thinking a little. Because if you're going to be forward thinking, you want to look at challenges and understand challenges that you yourself, with the limitations of your experience, cannot see. So you want to bring in that combination of diverse lived experiences that will allow the board to fulfill its responsibility to overcome gaps and see opportunities and progress towards the goals. So as a board, you also want to have functional roles, but this sense of the functional role that can only be fulfilled by a certain profile that I unconsciously hold is where the board members have to step back, neutralize that perception of who the right looking expert is that has to be brought in, and be open to both the lived experience and the expertise that somebody outside of their historical perspective can be.
That's great advice. Thank you for that, Indira. So earlier, we were talking about learning more, reading more, discovering more before you maybe take a step down the path. Can you recommend some platforms, continuing education opportunities for people in the third sector who would like to start to really learn more about this? Where can people go to find this information? Hopefully low resource, low cost, no cost information so they can learn more.
There's a plethora of organizations, academic institutes, professional trainers who are easily accessible through searches, but also through networking. The reason that I'm hesitant to name one resource or one expert is because the application has to fit your organization. The idea of learning honestly starts with oneself. It's recognizing first and foremost your own unconscious bias. So as one seeks to educate for the sake of the organization, the first step is getting past your own blinders. There's something to be said for leaders to work with diversity consultants or engage and review materials that speak to what is important for them to learn before they lead in this manner.
Well, one of the resources that I do want to plug again, though, is the website creedinaction.org, because you have a learning hub there. Can you talk a little bit about how that works and
Absolutely.
How people can access it?
Absolutely. As I said, one of the primary goals of Creed is talking about racial and ethnic equity and normalizing talking about racial and ethnic equity in a safe space. So while we created the glossary and frequently asked questions to open up the channels for communications, we've also created a learning community. As of now, we have 94 signatories of the pledge. They are both for-profit and non-profit, large, small, and medium organizations. We also have about 9 to 10 allies who haven't signed the pledge, but are committed to supporting the pledge. We've created opportunities for ongoing discussions. We do two types of learning. One is about defining what the constructs are, bringing in inspirational speakers who can speak to what the construct is. What is the difference between DEIA and REE, as you so articulately put it yourself? And then saying, now that we have a platform of this definition in discussion, we have gone into defining how to operationalize component one. So we lean on our own members as they are and create communities of practice where there's a couple of months of research that they do and then dialogue amongst themselves on the how to. And then we present it to our signatory community about these are the lessons we've learned. These are some of the practices we've cultivated. That here are some questions we're still struggling with. It's an ongoing aspirational journey that we will continue to strive for. But the idea is creating platforms to discuss what works, what doesn't work on an ongoing basis.
I love that the way it's designed is like a community of practice. So it's people coming together and saying, what's working for you? What's not working for you? And it seems like among the members there, you must have a high sense of trust in order for people to be able to come back and share their failures. That can be hard enough to do internally, let alone with an external group.
That is by design, and those are the values. We've acknowledged that we have a journey ahead of us. And when you come from that perspective, the goal is to learn. And to learn, it's okay to not get it right the first time, as long as the intention remains to continue to dialogue and debate and understand and bring in additional viewpoints to get to the next level of solution. So what I have to say that has been absolutely admirable about this community of over 100 organizations who are in truth competitors is the transparency with which the community of practices work. And within that, the mode is inquiry. It's not whether we've got it right or wrong. But when you look at it from a perspective of inquiry with an intent to build something, there's less in judgment.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Indira. Are there any parting thoughts that you'd like to share with the folks listening today about what we talked about?
You know, two things. One is forgive yourself for being human. You know, it's one of those things that when we work to fulfill high ideals, we have to give ourselves grace. And we have to know that it's only in movement and dialogue that there is forward motion towards our goal. And especially as leaders, I appreciate the burden. Having been a small business, I appreciate the challenge. But we don't take these responsibilities lightly. But by giving ourselves grace, we allow ourselves to learn. So I value the opportunity to be part of your community and really invite people to be open to what they don't know. And that includes how to build racial and ethnic equity. The second thing I wanted to share is we're almost at our 1 year anniversary of Creed. And it's a spiritual journey as much as it's a strategic process and an opportunity to convene people from very different perspectives to build something really important. And we're coming together on the 22nd of February to celebrate the fact that we are a community, that we are committed, and we're not stopping. So we invite your listeners to join us virtually or in person on the 22nd of February. There is information on our website at creedinaction.com. And I just want to thank you for this really thought-provoking dialogue, for your questions. And in a lot of ways, I learn more when somebody really has taken the time to open up what we're trying to do as beautifully as you have. So I'm grateful to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Indira. That means a lot to me, especially coming from you. It's been so inspirational just to hear you speaking today. And it's really fired a lot of the neurons in my brain to think about things slightly differently. If there are other people who have been listening today who are feeling the same way, and they would like to reach out to you, talk to you more, learn more about what we've talked about today, how can people find you out there if they have more questions?
No, that's very kind. Thank you very much. I'm on LinkedIn. I also can be reached through Creed at creedinaction@gmail.com.
Wonderful.
So C-R-E-E-D inaction@gmail.com or through our website.
Excellent. All right. Well, we'll put that information in the show notes. And thank you again for your time today, Indira. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
I am grateful. Thank you so much.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.